Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Many people wonder if they're contactees. They often describe childhood memories or dreams or obsessions. Here's some examples recently received during this past week or so in my email queue. I often awake at night with the feeling that something is pulling at my feet and it really freaks me out. And from another, how do you know if you're being watched by another species? I ask this because I do not suffer from paranoia, but sometimes I feel like I'm being monitored for some reason. And from another, some time ago I had a vision while sleeping. It was too clear to be a dream. It was more like seeing with my eyes. I can find in my neighborhood hills that fit with this vision, except the sea level is lower now. And from another, I have a memory of being in clouds while talking is going on. I seem to be agreeing. I think it was before I was born. I don't know what, if anything, is to be other than a dream, but I've thought about this since I can remember. And from another, I'm from Indonesia. I experienced a dream about 10 years ago. I sense an entity on my left side. Suddenly my body begins floating, and then I begin moving my body wildly because I'm scared. After that, I had many dreams that I got into a spacecraft. Please tell me, am I a contactee? And from another, many people within this community have a strong sense that we must gather seeds, knowledge, etc., and head for higher ground. And from another, a couple of years ago, someone I couldn't see but could hear came into my bedroom and touched me on the forehead, followed by an electric shock. And from another, I have dreams that are coming true in time. I'm seeing and feeling things before they are happening. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing good things regarding our planet. And from another, I had an alien encounter right in my own home in the mountains of North Dakota. Later, I had what I thought was a brain aneurysm, but now I feel it was to prepare me for the end times and a new way of life soon to come on our planet. The doctors called it a miracle. They don't understand why I survived. Now they say it wasn't an aneurysm. They don't know what the heck it was. I am doing way too well, they say, for it to have been an aneurysm. And this is the end of the quotes. Because I get so much email, like the quotes above, requesting what I have termed personal counseling, I've declined to do this since 1996. For instance, those questions above didn't get answered. I don't comment one way or the other. And I do this because it would overwhelm my workload. I can either do the Zeta Talk website and do interviews, do new Zeta Talk and the like, or I can answer personal questions. That's what it came down to. Just to let you know, so I don't mislead anybody, that they can flood my email queue, and I actually have this posted on my website in the Contact Nancy section. I state no personal counseling. What do the Zetas say about these vague feelings that people have? They've answered this in Zeta Talk in general terms to help people get their own answers from the body of Zeta Talk. How does one determine if they are a contactee? In the past, Clueless have been published on the internet. I think they were based on common symptoms that contactees had exhibited, like if they went in for hypnosis by Hopkins, or if they were in contactee support groups, common symptoms. Any truth to these lists? I mean, for instance, if you suffer from allergies, does this mean you're a contactee? And I quote from Zeta Talk, Clueless. A popular pastime in those discussing the alien presence and the wealth of information on what contactees experience, both during their visitations and afterwards, when struggling to live a double life in human society, is the clue list. Every symptom of anxiety or nervous tension is listed, with the erstwhile contactee assured that if they can check off a dozen or more of these symptoms, then they are most likely a contactee. The problem with these lists is that any and all of these symptoms occur in the populace as a whole, are regularly part of the human experience, and do not, in and of themselves, indicate a contactee status. Even symptoms such as brain buzz or irritated draining ears do not in and of themselves indicate a contactee status. And most certainly, allergies are common enough to be considered almost normal for the human condition. Thus, no assurance can be gotten from a simple clue list, including such clues as recall of visitations, which can and often are simply imagination, a reaction to reading contactee literature. Sorting out whether one is or is not a contactee is not a simple matter and involves the intensity of recall, the presence of smells and touch during recall, as well as visual memories and correlation of the appearance of scars and missing time with recalled incidences, and remembrance of factors routinely present in visitations prior to reading or learning about them from outside sources, and other such confirming circumstances. Checklists are designed in the main to intrigue the reader and sell magazines or increase website activity, not to help the populace determine their contactee status. Would you conclude you had a cancer based upon a checklist? Or perhaps conclude that you needed to go to a divorce attorney and institute proceedings based on a checklist? Or sell your car and buy another based on a checklist? Checklists have their place, but not in complicated situations involving a number of variables. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Clue Lists, written on April 15, 1997. Where clue lists cannot determine your status as a contactee, there is some validity to some of the symptoms listed. For instance, allergies. I quote from Zeta Talk, Allergies. Allergic reactions are very much under the influence of one's mental state, caused as they are by a heightened immune system reaction where the body is hyper alert, as it were. Nervous tension makes allergies worse, as any asthma sufferer will attest. Contactees are certainly dealing with tense situations. Not only is the visit itself strange and a bit unnerving, but the situation on the home front in most cases is not supportive. The contactee cannot share their experiences, and if they do, find they are ostracized and treated with disdain. Thus, the strangeness of the situation cannot be lessened in the time-honored manner that humans use to reduce their anxiety, talking it out with others. The contactee must bury their anxieties rather than express them, and the outcome is often, in those who are allergy-prone, an allergy attack. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Allergies, written February 15, 1997. And problems such as irritated draining ears can be related to contactee activity. And here's how. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Ear Problems. The ear is a sensitive organ designed to alert the human to a loss of balance as well as serving as the hearing sense. Loss of balance, or falling, is sensed by a change in blood pressure, the delicate difference between what is going on in one side of the head versus the other. This dual role of the ears involves the ear in visitations in a way that confuses many contactees. Ringing in the ears, temporary loss of hearing, pain in the ears, or excessive drainage from the ears due to such irritations. During visitations, a contactee may be suddenly taken on a quick trip to a ship. And if the contactee is afraid of heights, this can be alarming, resulting in blood pressure raise. The contactee may be paralyzed for ease of passage and to reduce anxieties, but when coming out of this state, the contactee may have sudden changes in blood pressure as the body adjusts to being alert again. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Ear Problems, written October 15, 1996. A sudden trip to a spaceship? A paralyzed state? What's all this about? There are ways to get a contactee quickly onto a ship. I call it being sucked up like a giant vacuum cleaner into a ship port. I've experienced this a lot, especially during the business day when I would be asked telepathically to take a break and step out on a veranda or out on the street. In high heels, I would usually end up on my bum after landing in the port, and dreading heights seldom opened my eyes to see the landscape below. Did it once, that was all. There I was, zooming up, and the odd thing is, it doesn't feel like suction coming from the bottom up because my skirt would have been wrapped around my ears. Instead, my clothing was wrapped around my body as though I was inside of a swirl, an air swirl, all of this invisible. And I've experienced ear irritation for years, or teleporting is another means by which you can get quickly into a spaceship where you're one place and suddenly you're another place. As a la the Star Trek series where people disappear, but this is very rapid. You don't have any sense of fading out in one place. It's like, boom, you're in another place. During all of this, if the contactee is very nervous or likely to flail about and hurt themselves, they are paralyzed. Please remember that contactees are asking for their visits. They want this. This is not something done to them. This is just no more complicated than the driver of the bus saying, please watch your step. And I quote from Zeta Talk, paralyzed state. The state of paralysis that many contactees report is common and is used not only as a means of calming and controlling potentially violent contactees, but also for convenience. The paralyzed state is very relaxing and leaves no harmful traits. During travel between the Earth and a spaceship, through walls, and at rapid speeds, humans often prefer to be paralyzed. In fact, this is a frequent request of the constant contactee, as they find it can rest and, as you say, leave the driving to us. What's going on in the state of paralysis? At times the mind is aware, at times as though in a deep sleep. Some contactees report they can break out of the paralysis with a shout or by a force of will. The mechanism used to place humans into paralysis is simple and does not involve our technologies or manipulation of densities. We are utilizing an existing human physiology, something akin to the frozen state that possums take when frightened. Why is it that humans never play possum when we or other aliens aren't around to induce this? Because this facility is deep within the reptilian brain and not connected to the middle brain or frontal lobes, humans voluntarily cannot reach this spot. But if one knows where it is and knows what buttons to push, then presto. A contactee picked up during a busy day will find themselves returned to the exact spot they left, but will be relaxed when this occurs. This sudden need to have their legs tensed under them will create a sense of falling and catching oneself. This can create a sense in the contactee that their knees temporarily gave out and is confusing. Another often reported confusion is what is termed sleep paralysis. The contactee is returned to bed, as most visits are done at night when missing time will not be noticed. The contactee, hardly asleep when returned, finds themselves in a conscious stream of memory as suddenly waking, but paralyzed. After a moment, the trigger switch that was flipped to create paralysis releases, and the contactee finds they can move again. They are often aware, subconsciously, that a visit has taken place, and relate the two as they should. However, the visit did not create paralysis per se. This is akin to dust on the boots after a walk, a remnant of the visit only. And this is the end of the quote from Paralyzed State, written July 15, 1995. And yes, I've had that experience during busy days at the office, suddenly finding my legs buckling under me. For years, before I knew that I was a contactee, I kind of wondered if I was having an epileptic fit. And why, where was this coming from? Suddenly my knees would kind of buckle, and I'd have to, whoops, you know, and I would sort of reach out and grab a chair and pretend I momentarily twisted my ankle there in my high heels. The double life of a contactee, just lovely. But the standard and oft-reported method is simply asking the contactee telepathically to take a walk out in the woods where a spaceship has landed. This was, in fact, my first meeting. And I quote from my hypnotic recall on that. I want you to note during this quote that I'm spending some time putting myself into the setting, reminding myself how it was, so I could start catching the beginning of the story, get back into the setting and then more easily catch the end of the string, the start of that memory in my subconscious. This is not a bad practice when meditating or trying to allow a visitation recorded only in the subconscious to emerge. Put yourself in a setting as well as relax. And I quote from my recall, first meetings. This was when I was a child, perhaps 7 or 8 years old, and ran around in pigtails and little coverall blue jeans, climbed trees. I was a tomboy. And here's the quote. I went down into the swamps a lot, so many frogs, and at night the frogs would be a chorus. It would be like the lapping of water on a beach. It would be so thunderous in a soft way. I'd chase frogs during the day and catch their green bodies and then let them go. There were so many frogs in the swamp, big swamp. When you looked off across the swamp, the mist would rise. It was a flooded pasture and the trees were a backdrop along the river there. Nobody ever went there, but I would walk in the woods in those tall trees. And when you were in those woods, you didn't know that anything else was around you. Nobody could see you. Nobody could hear you from the railroad tracks. Nobody could see you from the woods. And there was no traffic at all on the road. You were just alone. So I'd go down in the woods a lot and look out across the swamp at the woods. And when I'd go down there, I'd be all by myself, walking in those woods. I'd be gone for hours. Nobody would know where I was because the trees were so big. The fallen trees had big trunks covered with mushrooms, big fern fronds, some poison nettles that you had to worry about touching, but mostly just those big trees. Nobody ever went there. I was a little girl. I had coveralls, blue coveralls, and maybe a red t-shirt underneath. I'd go down in those woods there and I would be very observant. I would expect to find almost anything. I was very curious about animals, and I would be very quiet and watch for them. This time, I think I'm standing still, but it's actually somebody watching me down there in those woods. I'm standing still, and I'm having that feeling going up my spine when you do that, you know somebody's around, but you don't know where they are or who they are. So I have that feeling up my spine. I'm by a fallen tree. I can't see what it is that I'm nervous about, but out of the corner of my eye, I see a movement from the left coming out from behind a tree. I think there's something to the right, too, but I'm not sure. Somebody just steps out from behind a tree. It's one of those skinny guys, very gray, light gray, actually. They almost look smaller than me. I don't know what to make of it. Nothing's said, and I'm just staring. Then I feel like there's more to the right and to the left. So I guess I'm not alarmed by this, because I'm so used to wild creatures like the rabbits we had for pets. So many wild creatures are very quiet, like deer, and they only show themselves when they feel safe. So I'm not alarmed by this. I'm seeing some sort of a disc shape, small. It's a small disc shape, maybe 12 foot across, not that large. I'm pretty curious. I guess my initial reaction was curiosity more than fear. I'm trying to figure out what this is. I don't feel anything hostile. It seems like we just walk toward that ship, and there's a ramp that's let down from it. I feel a little nervous at one point when we're going up into the ship, and I'm thinking it's a tight enclosed space, and I don't know why we're doing this. The trees are dark, just very dense woods, and the weeds along the river made it very enclosed. I don't think I'm doing any resisting. They seem interested in my head and my hands and my wrists. They seem to be examining my hands and my wrists, the way my wrists bend. They seem to be putting their hands on either side of my head, almost like they're sizing it, looking at the very top of my head for some reason. Curious little creatures, very gray, light gray. even slightly smaller than I am, although I couldn't have been more than 8 years old. One of them looks at me, puts his face down to mine, eye contact, I guess, and seems to be trying to communicate something. Maybe he's saying, "Do you know why we're here? Do you know what we want? Maybe it's because I'm not afraid." Maybe that's what he's thinking, that I already know. I'm just trying to search and find out if I do know. But I just keep thinking that they're really curious little creatures. There's something at the side that looks like a tiny tray at the dentist office where they have this little mirror on a stick and things like that. It's off to the right-hand side, and it makes me just a little bit nervous to think about that. I think maybe they're going to do something with my right forearm, like when someone takes blood or something, poke around in your forearm a little bit. But I don't think anything's happening exactly. Maybe up by my elbow somewhere they're doing something toward the back of my elbow, but it's not too significant. I'm more interested in the dark eyes and how he seems to be trying to communicate something. He keeps saying, "Do you know why we're here?" And I'm not sure why. It's got something to do with the greenness of the woods and the way I love nature. I'm always wandering off and spending time alone in nature. I actually just watch nature, kind of get into it, empathize, get lost in it, observing. I'm very comfortable with it, very open. He's telling me that my grandmother's like that, that she loves nature, is very curious. He's telling me I'm going to have a role because of this. He says, "Do you know why we're here?" That's something to do with the vastness of the woods and how beautiful that is, how it should be that way, it should stay that way. I'm trying to think, what else? Let's see. He's telling me about my grandmother and how they talk to my grandmother about me, too. It seems that I laid back down on a table, but it wasn't really flat, something more like a chaise lounge. They wanted to look at my feet. I would go barefoot a lot. How my feet bend at the ankle, and checking out my wrists, how they bend, and I think they're going to do something with my forehead. They don't take my clothes off. They just bend my head forward a little and kind of shield my eyes or tell me to close my eyes now. And they do something to my forehead. I'm not really aware of any discomfort. I think basically I trust these guys. They have their hands at the side of my head, pulling my face up, trying to check it out. They've got my head at an angle and they do something to my forehead. They position my head like they're checking out the top of my head earlier. It's a little bit sore, but it's kind of like a dull ache. Now I don't feel like I want to think so much about what he was saying. Why are we here? I'm a little more distracted with that ache. I don't think they ever closed the door. It's a small ship. It's probably no larger than this living room. I tell him I want to go back to my frogs, and he says, "We'll be back." I'm thinking about those green frogs, how really beautiful they are when they jump and what they'd look like when they leap. They were always so wet, so hard to grab. The mist around the bushes, even the swamp water, fascinated me. So full of life. Ripples and bubbles and things like that. Then I think I just go and walk along the railroad tracks like I set out to do that morning. And then I just put it to the back of my mind. This is the end of my quote from First Meetings, which I relayed and put down in 1996. After this recall, I backed up to a mirror to look for any kind of a scar at the back of my elbow as confirmation that I hadn't been making this up. And sure enough, behind my elbow, there was a little nip. It looked like a mouse had taken a bite out of me. Where I'd never looked. Who looks there? But there it was. Note also in this recall the inference of family lines being contactees, my grandmother being someone who had talked to the Zetas. I realized later that the little Zetas might have been trying to get my soul to talk to my body, talk to Nancy's brain, about what I call a pre-birth agreement. I had made an agreement before birth, before being placed in this body as Nancy Leader, to be a contactee and to assume a communication role, give it a good try anyway, and it's panned out. Here I am talking to you. There certainly is also the inference that an implant might have been placed in my head somewhere during this visit. I kept looking at the top of my head, kept examining my forehead, and remember that dull ache that was distracting enough that I didn't want to chat with him anymore. I wanted to go back to walking along the railroad tracks, distract myself from the pain. Well, I have a remarkable story to tell regarding my forehead. When I was 12 years old in junior high school, I took swimming for gym, and I'd often walk home in the very cold Wisconsin winters. I mean, I'd get ice on my hair. My mother was horrified. And as a result, I had a lot of sinus infections, and the doctor would treat these by packing cotton in some sort of a green medication, stuffing this up my nose, and putting a diathermy pad over the bridge of my nose and my eyes, and let this heat up for a few minutes. Now, you can't do that if you have a fever. He'd always check for a fever thermometer, because a diathermy pad works by reacting to the heat coming from the body. Well, one time, the pad got up a little bit too high up into my forehead, the edge of the pad right across my forehead where the third eye is. And I was laying there, and I said, "Is it supposed to get this hot?" And he said, "Well, it's supposed to get warm." But when he took off the pad 20 minutes later or so, he was really horrified. He said, "Oh, dear, the flesh there in the center of my forehead where the third eye is had been cooked, third-degree burn, all the way through to the bone. I have this big white circle about, well, actually it kind of looks like a cross, but it's also about the size of a silver dollar, just there in my third eye location." Well, I was out of school for days. They checked the diathermy pad. Nothing wrong with it. He went back to using it. And my mother, for some reason, was absolutely casual about the fact that I had gotten my forehead seared like this at the doctor's office. She said, "Oh, well, must have been a faulty diathermy." Well, did she ever check with the doctor? No. She never bothered to ask him if this diathermy machine was faulty. I don't think he ever bothered. Well, it's almost like she knew what the reason was and was just being too casual, because that was not like her. Very protective mother. Another family member later, realizing he was a contactee in his early 20s, this is my son, had a sudden scar about the size of a quarter, an indentation in that very same spot. Well, this happened at a time that he was beginning to realize that he was a contactee, beginning to go for hypnosis sessions, and he was determined also to try to get somebody to take an x-ray of his head so he could look for implants. Boom! The next morning, instead, he had this indentation about an eighth of an inch deep in the center of his forehead, like a circle right where I had mine. I was stunned. Well, I asked some people that dealt with a lot of support groups, ufology, a woman from Los Angeles who is sort of the LA equivalent of Bud Hopkins, met her at a lecture in San Francisco, and went up to her afterwards and said, "Did you ever hear of this? You know, something in the forehead?" Because my son, under recall, had realized they were taking out little metal balls out of his forehead, about a dozen of them. And she said, "No, one behind the ear. I mean, there's always one thing, but not a bunch, and never the center of the forehead." Why just our family? I don't think those forehead little balls in my forehead, metal balls, were implants. When you think about it, that's exactly what would have caused the burn, because metal reflects heat, and the diathermy increases its heat based on the kind of heat that it's getting back from the body, so there would have been this bouncing back and forth that would have raised the temperature, and my flesh cooked. I don't think they were implants. I think they were to encourage some kind of communication, something to do with my role now, where I'm talking telepathically with the Zetas and relaying Zeta talk, maybe. But I think that's what it was about. But I also have no doubt that I must have gotten an implant during that first meeting, which I had asked for per the rules of contact. The human is always in control. Implants are used to locate the contactee for a quick visit. What are some of the symptoms of an implant? And I quote from Zeta Talk, Brain Buzz. "Implants are reported to cause lumps under the skin, bleeding from the nose, tingling when separated from the surface nerves that have grown around them, and a general sense of relief from intrusion and invasion when removed. All of these symptoms would be true of any foreign body in the object in the body. Unique to alien implants is their capacity to cause what many contactees describe as a jolt or buzz in the brain, a sensation that they cannot biologically reconcile. Some contactees seek medical advice, convinced they have a brain tumor, or if they experience a momentary loss of muscular control, maybe epilepsy. Combined with the ear problems many contactees experience, many also suspect a disease of the inner ear and run repeatedly to this specialist or that, seeking an explanation. What causes the jolt or buzz, and what purpose does it serve? Implants, as we have explained, are locating devices, allowing the contactee to be quickly located prior to a visitation. The device responds to a signal sent in all directions, an answering call. To generate the signal, the implant utilizes the nervous system. A signal is sent through the brain and bone and muscle. Within a dead body, the implant would not respond to this locating signal and thus inform the visitors, who in any case eventually would learn of the death of their contactee via spiritual routes, of a death. Implants also respond with a unique signal generated from the DNA of the contactee, so that the implant response confirms not only that the contactee is alive, but the implant is still located within the proper body. Thus, when contactees experience a jolt of buzz in the brain, they should not be alarmed. All is working as intended, and what they are experiencing confirms their link to the visitors they have asked to meet. And this is the end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Brain Buzz, written November 15, 1996. There's great controversy about implants, with those wanting the common man to be suspicious and guarded about contact, pointing to this as an intrusion. You've been abducted, you've been tagged, etc. Here's what the Zetas have to say about that. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Implants. Implants are without a doubt the most talked about contactee phenomenon. Where other matters are in fact more common than the implant phenomenon, implants get the most press. Why this focus on implants? Humans regularly tag wildlife in order to track it, tag their domestic animals so they can be found if lost, tag their cars so ownership can be proved, etch their name on the backs of valuable items, assign numbers such as social security numbers to identify each other, and expect their spouse to wear a ring. Ownership. Just so, when humans realize that they themselves or others have been implanted, the worst notions of the tagging process that humans do to each other and to animals come to mind. Nazi death camps, where humans were tattooed with numbers so they could not escape their fate. Men who smashed their wives in the face so the scars and broken nose will announce to the world that they cannot escape their brutality. Livestock to be culled from the herd, marked with bright colors so they cannot be missed, and wildlife tagged so they can be recaptured and perhaps killed or dissected for science. Humans being tagged? What can this mean? Implants must be put into the perspective of the wider picture. Contactees are all volunteers. Tagged or not, they can end their status as contactees at will. They have the power. Therefore, implants are not a tag placed in a possession. Think of an implant, rather, as a type of portable, lightweight, ever-present telephone. The implant allows the aliens in contact to quickly locate the contactee, saving both a lot of time. Implants have been described as going up the nose, behind the ear, into the bones of the head, and under the skin. All that and more. They have been described as organic and structured to dissolve when removed. Some are that, and some are not. And some are not of organic materials at all. This is the end of Zeta Talk, Implants, written July 15, 1995. And then there are those who complain about contact with children. The government and organized religions can't stop this process. Well, they can brainwash children, but the visitors have no right to respond to a request from the child, from that soul, often an old soul in that child, for contact. But this is their argument. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Dual Identities. Contactees who have been visited since early childhood often consider their visitors as much a part of the family as the humans related to them by blood. Visitations often start before the contactee has started school, and the first encounters are made in a setting the child associates with discovery and a sense of bonding with nature, so that these overtones continue as an association through life. The contactee finds their visitors responding to their unspoken call when they are anxious or deeply pondering a course in life. The contactee child is often discussing their dilemma and alternative paths with their visitors, even before their human parents or siblings are sought out as counsel. Thus, the child considers his visitors his first stop during times of trauma and bonds with his visitors as only comrades in combat can. Thus, by the time the contactee reaches adulthood, the contactee identifies with his alien visitors as much as with his human family. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Dual Identities, written September 15, 1996. Since around the time of Roswell, contact has only been recorded in the subconscious. This is due to the accelerating awakening process, where awareness of the alien presence will be increased rapidly. We're seeing a lot of spaceships, mass sighting of spaceships, glimpsing of alien bodies, etc. All this is on the increase, and at the same time, those people that are frightened of the alien presence are getting more alarmed, and those elements that are threatened by the alien presence, like organized religion or governments who are asked to protect their populace from threat, or maybe they're just control freaks, you know, and U.S. military, for instance, or military, they're control freaks, and they say, well, how dare they come around? Anybody who might be threatened or frightened, this also would be ramped up. So, to keep contactees safe from attack, being burned at the stake or stoned or thrown into the wacky ward or ostracized by their neighbors or fired or whatever, it's kept low in their subconscious so that they're aware of it, but they don't run screaming down the street saying, I just met with an alien and it was so cool and let me tell you about it, and boom, they're in trouble. I quote from Zeta Talk, Subconscious. During face-to-face contact, we disconnect the conscious. These memories are not recorded at all in your conscious, which is a different part of your brain than from your subconscious. Humans have the capacity to disconnect their conscious and subconscious, and quite frequently do so. For instance, if a memory is painful, it can be forgotten. However, in all these circumstances, the subconscious remembers the facts. It is the conscious which deals in falsehoods. Subconscious memories of our face-to-face meetings are as effective as a full conscious memory. The distress a schism between the conscious and subconscious causes a human occurs when the human finds they just up and do something where they previously didn't know they had this intention. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Subconscious, written July 15, 1995. Well, this leads most certainly to that double life syndrome I've been talking about, dealing with alternative realities. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Alternative Realities. Contactees, regardless of their conscious awareness of their status, find themselves in a puzzling world. Human society has scarcely become comfortable with the concept of telepathy, ridiculing those who claim this form of communication exists, even when proven in a controlled laboratory setting. The concept of spirits, such as ghosts or reincarnation or possession, is considered in the realm of tales rather than the reporting of fact, especially as spirits leave no mark or footprints. What cannot be physically restrained cannot exist in the minds of many. So brain waves or spirit forms are speculative. Where does this leave the contactee? Contactees who have not yet realized their status, or who have not yet sorted out memories from the spirit from memories stored in the corporeal mind, can be highly confused. At first, the contactee's subconscious memories of visitations are treated as an overactive imagination. But then signs such as scars that appear overnight begin to intrude. Subconscious memories of visitations play out during recall with full sound and color, as you say, so that the memory unfolds like a movie. Thus, an experienced contactee who has sorted out the alternative realities finds their life no more confusing than a shopper discovering clothing on the racks from different countries and in different styles. After a while, it all just seems normal. And this is a quote from Zeta Talk, Alternate Realities, written on September 15, 1996. By being recorded only in your subconscious, remembering or recall can be gradual at a pace comfortable to the contactee, a pace comfortable to their social setting. Perhaps they're in an uptight community, in an uptight family. No way could they start talking about this. And they just don't have recall, but subconsciously, down deep in their gut, they know what's going on. So this protects the contactee. And I quote from Zeta Talk, remembering. Some contactees remember immediately and think they've been aware all along. In fact, this is not what occurs, but rather immediately after the visitation, the contactee connects the memory in their subconscious to the conscious. This process is similar to the physiological process humans use to restore their past after amnesia periods. The recall can be paced, being suppressed again if the contactee does not feel ready. Remembering, therefore, is on an individual basis, and the individual contactee is fully in control, which is as it should be. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Remembering, written July 15, 1995. To discover the story of a visitation in full sound and fury and color, meditation or self-hypnosis is often used. Having done this myself, I can tell you the process is simple. One simply has to relax utterly, and I'm talking about not a tense muscle in the body. The best way to do this is to start by concentrating on parts of your body to make sure you're relaxing each muscle. Start with your feet. Come up your legs, up your trunk, down your arms, and then from your shoulders up through the neck to the top of the head, then go back the other way again, making sure you've got all of them. Concentrate and say, relax, relax. By this time, you're limp as a wet noodle. Your mouth may be hanging open. I'm not kidding you. You're loose. Now you clear your mind of all thoughts and allow whatever wants to pop into your conscious mind to do so. If there's a story pressing to come out that your subconscious wants to relay to you, that you've been asking, really, to be consciously aware of, then that's what will pop into your mind. Now don't resist. Let that story unfold unhindered. Don't argue about it. Don't say, this can't be so. Just let it play out. You are in complete control of yourself during this whole process. All that business of hypnosis making somebody hop around the stage and flap their arms like a chicken and the like, this is not really true. Hypnosis, in fact, is just a relaxed state, and you're in control of this. You want to stop the session? If someone walks in the room, or you just sneeze, or you just decide you have to get up and go to the bathroom, the session stops. I mean, you're in control. If you start thinking about other thoughts and concentrate on the day around you and the room around you, the session has stopped. That's how easy it is. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Hypnosis. Contactees desiring to recall their visits use various methods, including meditation, induced trance states, and hypnosis. All these methods are essentially the same in that they utilize a feature of the human physiology normally in force during dream states. As the human brain is less than holistic, due to the many genetic engineering passes made from a combination of reptilian and hominoid sources, it does not speak well to itself. Subconscious is aware of everything, but where the conscious is only partially aware, it is allowed, ostensibly, to be in charge. During dream states, the human conscious is bombarded with information. As the gates are not locked, the guard against the subconscious let down, and the gap between what the conscious thinks reality is and what the subconscious knows reality is are filled with a rush of information. During hypnosis or other deliberately induced trance states, the flood of information is controlled. The gates are let down gradually, so when the information begins to flow from the subconscious, as much time as is needed is taken to find a place to put it, making connections. This is why recall on a history of visitations seems to proceed slowly at first, but eventually reaches the point where a slight self-induced trance state is enough to bring the memory of a recent visitation over from the subconscious to the conscious. Visitations are placed only in the subconscious, so a base needs to be established in the conscious upon which to build the conscious memories. For those inexperienced with hypnosis or other trance state inducement, the key is relaxation and clearing the mind of all activity, all thoughts. Blank mind, utterly relaxed body, and bing, a thought pops into your conscious. Hypnosis does not create the thought. It allows the flood of information to begin prior to an actual sleep state. Some contactees find they begin remembering as they are dropping off or waking up from sleep. Hypnosis is most successful where there is a press of information waiting to flood over from the subconscious, which has been actively involved in sorting out a recent visitation or in reconciling visitations. Successful hypnosis also requires a conscious willing to recall. If the contactee is unwilling to recall, blocks this, then no amount of hypnosis will work. Contactees blocking conscious awareness will even wake themselves up from a dream state where progress is being made, fearful of the outcome. Others, desiring their life to be built of a single fabric, spend as much time as possible, sleeping or waking, weaving things together. End of the quote from Zeta Talk Hypnosis, written August 15, 1995. Please note here that they're talking about the alpha state. Anyone familiar with brain waves knows there's alpha, beta, theta. Theta is the anger. Beta is our normal wakeful activity. Alpha is the state when we're sleeping or when we're hypnotized or in a trance state. So this is why dreams and hypnosis have some relationship. But hypnosis is controlled. You're slowly taking one memory coming over and saying, oh, wait, I remember that shoe. I remember that's my old friend from high school, etc. So you're connecting it to your consciousness. Where in the dream state, it's just a flood and it's all hodgepodge and nonsensical. And I quote from Zeta Talk, just a dream. Many contactees recall their visitations as a dream, as the recall starts during a semi-sleep state, during that time when one is just dropping off to sleep or just waking up. However, there are characteristics that mark the recall as other than a dream. The dream seems vivid, so real, and includes elements not normally in dreams, such as sounds or smells. These dreams are usually so vivid as to wake the drowsy contactee. If the contactee is comfortable with the concept of the alien presence, they will dig further into their subconscious and unfold the story. But many simply leave the recall in the dream status, as this way the recall is less threatening. How could it be real? It was just a dream. And this is the end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Just a Dream, written July 15, 1995. If a contactee is uneasy about the visitations, because admitting them will put his life in contact, you know, the family doesn't believe in it, his church doesn't believe in it, his buddies don't, how can he talk about it? He'd rather have it all down and there in his subconscious. He may, in fact, block recall. And I quote from Zeta Talk, blocking. Many contactees find that, try as they may, they cannot recall their visitations as other contactees seem to do. All manner of attempts, including professional hypnosis, will be tried to no avail. What's going on here? In human society, and in particular in many contactees' lives, There is a conflict about the alien presence, and thus there can be conflict within the contactee. Does a spouse believe that man is not alone and is being visited by other beings from other worlds? Is the employer ultra-conservative, such that a slip of the tongue in the coffee room will place doubts in the employer's mind about the contactee's promotability? Is the family supportive, the friends accepting? Or will the contactee find they are increasingly treated as an eccentric and left out of social plans? Where the contactee fears repercussions in his life, he will tend to block. The mind is aware of these blockages as it has put them there, and thus can effectively resist attempts to get around them. In effect, the block is the result of the total mindset of the contactee. As with amnesia or coma, or just plain forgetfulness, that which the total mindset cannot deal with will tend to be pushed aside. In order to achieve recall, then, the contactee must make changes in their life so that recall is not a threat. Most find this difficult, especially if family or job or the marital situation is the problem. And this is the end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Blocking, written August 15, 1996. After individual contact is established, the contactee may begin meeting others on spaceships or in remote places like grassy fields or beaches. Most often, visits are at night when missing time is least likely to be noticed. Thus, group meetings might be peopled by folks in their pajamas or hurriedly dressed in the middle of the night while still sleepy. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Contact Groups. Group interactions validate experiences. The individual finding their night clothes on backwards knows there has been a visitation, but secretly wonders if perhaps their memory might be failing. In a group of contactees, a synergy takes place. First one and then another realizing, as others tell their tales, that they are not alone in their experiences. Within the contact group, details are shared that, if not appeared in print, could not therefore be faked, and are told with much emotion and conviction. When these details told by another match the listener's story, more than sharing takes place, and more than an awakening takes place, a transformation takes place. The contact group is now a group of humans who are no longer toying with an idea, no longer arguing with each other, but are facing the reality of the transformation calmly, with open eyes and open minds, and most often with open hearts. Thereafter, walking among others out in society, everything looks different. The frantic push to live better lives than the Joneses, the focus on the World Series, the chatter about the SETI project, all are put in a different perspective. It is as though all of humanity were in a trench and could not look out except for the few who stand tall. Those too short to see behave as though all that matters takes place in the trench, in their own little world. Those few tall enough to be glimpsing beyond know better, but can do little more than just look at each other and smile at the ignorance and short-sightedness around them. Such it is with members of contact groups who find they can only talk honestly among themselves. There is a transformation going on, a personal transformation, but no less important in the scheme of things. Great dunes are built from many grains of sand, and eventually the collective consciousness is such that this transformation momentum begins to affect society. Ideas presented at the table receive support rather than argument. Programs that affect the public are slanted toward the broader view in subtle ways. The little grains of sand are making mounds there where no one has noticed, as the wind blew them just a few at a time. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Contact Groups, written September 15th, 1995. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.